Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Boston in 1775 is an island city occupied by British troops after a series of incendiary incidents by patriots who range from sober citizens to thuggish vigilantes. After the Boston Tea Party, British and American soldiers and Massachusetts residents have warily maneuvered around each other until April 19th, when violence finally erupts at Lexington and Concord. In June, however, with the city cut off from supplies by a British blockade and Patriot militia poised in siege, skirmishes give way to outright war in the Battle of Bunker Hill. It would be the bloodiest battle of the Revolution to come and the point of no return for the rebellious colonists. Nathaniel Philbrick has written a new history of the battle, Bunker Hill, a city, a siege, a revolution, which brings a fresh perspective to every aspect of the story. He finds new characters and new facets to familiar ones. Nathaniel Philbrick is the author of In the Heart of the Sea, as well as Mayflower, Sea of Glory, and The Last Stand, Why Read Moby Dick, and Away Offshore. It's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable once again. Thank you very much for being back.
Oh, it's great to be back.
We appreciate having you here. This is, I was reading in an interview that you gave that ultimately your interest in this was piqued as a young boy in reading Johnny Tremaine.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of kids my generation, I read Johnny Tremaine, and it just had an impact. And I also saw, I think it was a Disney movie, and some of those scenes are imprinted in my brain.
I love that book.
Yeah, and that book by Esther Forbes just brought alive not only the characters, but the city of Boston. And that's the story I wanted to tell with Bunker Hill. The battle is the pivot point of the book. But the real, if there's a hero, it is the city of Boston, because what the Revolution did, whether you were a patriot or a loyalist, and, you know, it was not the way I think most of us were brought up thinking, that, you know, everything was the colonists against the British. It was much more complicated than that. No one was thinking of independence at the beginning of all this, and many people were undecided and didn't know on which side they were. And in many ways, this would prove to be a civil war. And so Boston is just a fascinating kind of petri dish of human behavior. As British soldiers arrive after the Boston Tea Party, tensions rise, and eventually violence unfolds.
How much has your past work led up to writing about this particular subject, writing about the Revolution, writing about Bunker Hill?
Well, you know, it was really Mayflower that set me on this path. Mayflower begins with that iconic voyage, but I end the book with the brutal English native war, King Philip's War, that was fought in 1675-76, exactly 100 years before the Revolution would explode in Boston. And with that book, I realized, whoa, there's going to be a lot of unfinished business in this century when it comes to the events that lead to the Revolution. And so I knew I wanted to go there, but before that, I also wanted to sort of follow the native Western tensions and violence that I had tracked in Mayflower out west. And so I wrote The Last Stand about the Battle of Little Bighorn. And I have to say, when it came to writing about the Battle of Bunker Hill, I was glad I had that experience in trying to bring warfare in a very different era to life.
And there's also a maritime aspect as well.
Yeah, you know, it was one of the things I think people don't realize. It wasn't just militiamen versus British regulars in Concord and Lexington. All of Boston Harbor, which is truly vast, and Boston is really just one, at that time was an island, but one of dozens of islands in this big harbor. And even though they were besieged by militiamen, the British Army in Boston was able, did have control of the harbor, because the British Navy was there with a bunch of men of war and other ships. But what the provincials had were whaleboats, Boston Harbor is shallow, filled with mud flats. And so what you see is this battle for resources on the islands going on, with a kind of cat and mouse game between the British and the New Englanders, and it's just fun to see it all happen, unfold on the water.
For you, what was the experience like of trying to establish what a city like Boston was like before the Revolution, given the great change, understandably, that has taken in the 200 plus years since?
Yeah, you know, as you indicate, you know, Boston today is unrecognizable when you look at the maps and the engravings, and there are some great watercolors of Boston at that time, and I've included some of them in my book. And you know, there, Boston now is basically filled of urban sprawl with skyscrapers where it used to be water. The Back Bay, the neighborhood called the Back Bay, was literally the Back Bay. It was all water. And Boston was studded with more than 50 wharves, and the island was dominated by three hills that were verging on mountains, with the almost medieval crooked streets at the foot. And so my research process involved maps in a way that I've never used them before. There's half a dozen very detailed maps that the British had made during the Siege of Boston, and there are other visual representations that were helpful. But I also went to Boston a lot, and I have an apartment in the city, and there are vestiges of the old Boston, the old South Meeting House, where the more than 5,000 people met on the night of the Boston Tea Party is still there. The old State House, which was known as the Town House, the seat of the General Court, which was the colony's legislative body, and near where the massacre unfolded, still exists. The church where Paul Revere put up his famous signal that the British were coming by sea. All those are there, and so it's been a process of, you know, kind of piecing it all together, and then going out to Lexington and Concord. You can really get a sense of what things were like by being there. And so it was a complicated process of trying to bring a past landscape to life.
As you beautifully write in the book and paint this picture of 15,000 people on just 1.2 square miles, and how this tension build and continued to build to the point where these merchants and farmers and citizens when they finally let go. What was it about that situation that was so special to that area that allowed that to happen?
Well, you know, I think one of the main ingredients to making the revolution happen occurred relatively early, in 1772. It was just 2 years after the Boston Massacre, when Samuel Adams invented the Committee of Correspondence, which was a 21-member committee that began to send out open letters to the more than 250 towns throughout Massachusetts. And in these letters, they were discussing the issues of the day, their troubles with Parliament, issues of the natural rights of man, the events leading up to the Tea Party. And what they did was they really created an independent communication system that circumvented the old hierarchical royal-based government and created turned town meetings that, you know, used to talk about things like building bridges and roads into chat rooms of talking about the issues of the day. And so what you see is in the 2 years that followed, people throughout Massachusetts are expressing their sympathy for what's going on in Boston, and it's knitting the colony together in a way that the British royal government had never anticipated. And so, you know, it's this, and it meant that it wasn't just Bostonians versus the British. It was all of Massachusetts. And in fact, when it came to the most radicals, they were the ones that lived in what they were referred to as the country towns. And these, they were not only, they were also had muskets. Each town had its militia, and so they were prepared to fight.
You talk about ambivalence and sort of a surprise that in our story of the Revolution that very natural human emotion has kind of been written out of what we think of when we think of
absolutely.
Revolution.
Absolutely, you know, I think I, like most people, saw the Revolution as basically patriots versus the British. It was that simple, and there was really no bones about it, but it was not that way at all. Independence was not seen as part of the picture. That's only hindsight where we see the unrest leading in that direction. People desperately hoped that their problems with the British Empire could be resolved. Even radicals like Samuel Adams referred to London and England as home. This was a tie that was very important to people, and yet, as they pushed for their rights, and the path began to lead towards greater autonomy from the empire, it began to mess with people's heads. And you know, there were those that would, you know, were on what would become the revolutionary side from the beginning, and there are those that were on what would become the loyalist side from the beginning. But most people didn't know really where they stood. They wanted it just to be the way it had always been. And that's kind of the fascinating thing about a revolution, is to see when you reach the point where people have to decide. Like it or not, you got to choose.
When in your research of the story, and you think of the significant players in this, I was surprised by some of the main characters who were not who I thought were would be the main characters. Did you find that?
Yeah, you know, I think all of us think, when we think of the Revolution in Boston, we think of John Adams, Sam Adams, John Hancock. But
yeah,
what happened was, when the actual things were unfolding in terms of the on-the-ground revolution in Boston and New England, those leaders were away. They were either at Philadelphia or on their way to Philadelphia, where the Second Continental Congress was meeting. And so it was left to a 33-year-old doctor, Dr. Joseph Warren, who was a charismatic, kind of swashbuckling leader, to really orchestrate what was happening as far as the revolution. You know, he was the last of these patriot leaders in Boston. He was there in Boston on the night of April 18th when he gave Paul Revere the orders to alert the countryside that the British were coming. I mean, we all know Paul Revere, but none of us know who gave him the orders. And it was this young doctor. The next morning, when he heard the news of Lexington, he would find a way to escape Boston, cross the river, and actually would join the fighting as the militia chased the British back to Boston. And then after Lexington conquered, he was voted president of the Provincial Congress. He would lead the Committee of Safety, which was effectively the executive body. And so that he was basically the head of both branches of the provincial government, and he was 33 years old, and he was also realized that if this was going to turn into a war, he wanted to be there as a general, and so he was appointed a major general just days before the Battle of Bunker Hill, and he was there in the midst of that fighting, and unfortunately would be killed on the last British charge, and as a consequence, he's faded from view, but if he had lived, he might have very well been one of the founding fathers we revere today.
We're just about out of time, but does this naturally bring you to your next subject?
You know, I think it might. I just found this whole period fascinating. All my books are about America, and clearly the Revolution is one of the primary formative elements when it comes to this nation. And I found myself by the end, you know, when Washington takes over after the death of Warren as the leader of the Continental Army and the British finally evacuate, I found myself, I want to follow what happens to these guys. So, you know, I'm not absolutely sure just yet what the next step will be, but I got a feeling I may be remaining in this period.
Well, that's good to hear. In the meantime, this book is out and is wonderful. It's Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution, and is published by Viking. Nathaniel Philbrick, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for spending time with us.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. Again, Nathaniel Philbrick's Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution is out from Viking. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.